During these dry summer months, you will notice more aggressive yellow jackets flying around. Yellow jackets are looking for your barbecue meat, sweet drinks, as well as water sources. You can keep them at bay with rescued yellow jacket traps. Rescue yellow jacket traps are eco-friendly, do-it-yourself option to keep the stinging pests away from you. These traps are a powerful lure for yellow jackets and will not attract beneficial honeybees. You can find all rescue products that are made in the USA at rescue.com. That is rescue.com.
Absolutely. Gardening with Joy and Holly Radio Show back with you. And Holly, let's go to the hotline and bring in our guest for this week.
Eva Monheim is a horticultural and environmental consultant, an educator with a vast experience in the green professions. She is the co-founder of V, which is Verdant Earth Educators. She has contributed to many publications, and she's also an author. Her book is called Shrubs and Hedges. Welcome to the program, Eva.
Oh, thank you, Holly and Joey. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Well, we appreciate you taking time, and I think you're going to educate Holly and myself and all of our listeners, so we're excited for that.
So what is V, the Verdant Earth Educators, and what inspired it?
Well, Verdant Earth Educators is a company that works with residential and commercial green industry clients. We do consulting on site to address planning, growth, sustainability, and diversity. And we also do garden coaching and employee training. And this is a really big area where more and more companies are doing personal development for their staff. And that's where we come in. We'll train their staff. We also write landscape management plans for homeowners and companies for the bidding process and for proper and consistent care. And our teams do site analysis on environmental design, pruning, safety training, stormwater mitigation training. And in addition to that, we also do plant ID, tree inventories, performance mulching, and show proper staging strategies for when companies are working on site.
So what inspired this? Was this something that you created or you just became a part of?
No, my colleague Louise Clark and I, she was a former student of mine at the university. And then afterwards, she was actually, I recommended her to work at the university because I needed a biology instructor. And she was excellent in biology because that's her background. She was a medical technical person. And she moved into the horticulture field. And we were looking at different landscapes because we traveled together with the Garden Communicators International. And we would look at different sites and we'd say, look at that problem, or look at how poorly that's done. And so what we did was we decided we were going to start a company that would empower people to do the right methodology when they were planting a tree, not putting a mulch volcano, pruning the branches correctly, pruning the shrub correctly, empowering people to actually help them. So it's from an educational standpoint, not everybody wants to go to college and not everybody can afford to go to college, but to go and have a session one-on-one, like right now we're doing family training. One client, I go to their house and just actually train the whole family.
When you said that, I knew you were going to bring up volcanic mulching because we see that to be a very big problem with municipalities that are supposed to know better. For people who don't know what that term means and maybe are doing it, can you briefly go over what that term means and the damage in which it can cause a tree?
Oh, sure. It's like having your foot in plaster Paris and not being able to move it. What mulch does is it, when it's put up against the bark of the tree, it's put up against an area that needs to be exposed. So any place where there's bark on the tree that's hard, you want to leave it open to the air. And there is what we classify a root flare or foot to the tree. And that foot is there to help the tree get thicker, and it helps it to move in the wind. And that movement actually thickens the base of the trunk of the tree so that it can withstand heavier winds, difficult weather conditions, and so on. So mulching high up on the tree actually causes disease and forces the tree to push out roots where they shouldn't be. and it destabilizes the main roots that are buried underneath this thick layer of mulch, and then they can't breathe.
And you would, and I would recommend, and you could correct me, about 1 inch of mulch, 3 foot away from around the base of the tree, outward from the trunk, and that would be good enough, and you don't have to worry about bumping in with the lawnmower or anything like that. Would you consider that to be a good starting base?
Right. Yeah, you want to keep the mulch away from the actual root flare, but you're right. You want to have a thin layer of mulch on the overall covering of the root system. And when you do that, as you mentioned, you're not bringing the heavy lawnmowers over the roots to compress the roots, especially when the soils are moist or wet. You shouldn't really be mowing anyway, but sometimes you have to mow. And that reduces the overall compression around the root zone. And you're right. That's what I would do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you have a book. It's called Shrubs and Hedges. What inspired that book, and what can our listeners expect, or maybe like a intriguing tip to encourage them to pick up a copy?
Well, the book has been inspired by my teaching at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. I teach in their certificate program, and the class I teach is shrubs. And it's a really fascinating course because most people don't ever look at a shrub as something that's at our eye level. But it's a critical point within the context of a woodland or in the landscape, because being able to see something at your own eye level makes you more aware of activity that's happening. And so if we have bees right in line with our eyes, we're more attentive to them. So the whole idea of having the shrub book was intriguing to me, because people were asking lots of questions about shrubs that I just took for granted because I knew about. And so the book came out, and one of the areas that I talk about are hydrangeas. And hydrangeas, we're like in the middle of the hydrangea craze since 2003, when the first endless summer hydrangea came out. It prompted other breeders to breed better performing plants, ones that have greater color, larger heads, beautiful structures. And so now we're getting lots of different types of hydrangeas, and the breeding continues. And I can see this going for the next 10 or 15 years down the line. And each year we get new ones. So in the book, there's actually a chart that tells you when to prune it, if it needs to be pruned, when it blooms. And there's about 75 different hydrangeas in the book. And I know that several professionals have told me in the field that this is a really invaluable source of information for anybody who is doing planting of hydrangeas in their gardens or professionally in a public garden. So that's one of the things that I have I feel is really important.
So the hydrangea, because of competition, we were able now to enjoy so many different more types of beauty with that particular type of flower or bush, shrub, hedge, because one company started, and then everybody else said we got to be bigger and better, and now we've got a lot of great selections to choose from.
We do, and we have some in tree form, like the hydrangea paniculata or the panicle hydrangea, and we have reblooming arborescence, which is our native hydrangea, and we also have some new ones coming on, the Aspera hydrangea. They're working on that. But the idea of having a range of different flower type heads, you know, the round head, the flat lacy kind, the lace cap, what they call lace cap, and of course the big panicles that you see on a tree like structure. There's just so many out there, and they're breeding them for smaller gardens, for containers, to use as a small tree. Rather than having a really big tree in your backyard, you can have a small tree of hydrangeas. So there's a whole range of them, and you're exactly right. One plant prompted a whole cascade of breeding to happen.
Now, let's talk about shrubs and bushes, or hedges and bushes. What are some tips that you can offer homeowners before they go and just buy the first one they see when they walk in the garden center? What are some things that they need to consider before filling in a spot with just any old hedge or bush?
Well, that's a really great question. One of the things I really like to discuss with people when I'm out on the lecture circuit, I'll say, you know what, first of all, take a look at your garden and see where you might have a hole, where you want to have create a visual impact, a focal point, for example. And take a look at the size, measure it. Go out and actually measure the space. See what the aspect or direction, like direction that you have there. Is it east, southeast? Is it west? How is it facing? And then once you have that information, you can go into a garden center equipped with how large of a plant you really need. And I always say, use a larger space, but get a slightly smaller plant, because sometimes they grow bigger than what they say they will on the tag. So if it's 3x3, you have a 3x3 space, well, get something that'll grow 2.5x2.5. Or if it says you have a space 6x6, get something that'll grow 5x5. And that way you don't have to prune. Because if you don't have the right measurements, you're going to commit yourself to us every season having to prune. And you shouldn't have to do that with all the selection now in the market.
And some people will just go in and go, 50% off, grab it, hun. And that's not the answer to the situation.
I love that, Joey. It's so true, because a lot of times we waste more money on thinking we're saving money than if we really think smart about how we're going to go about it. And I always like to tell students and clients to go to the garden center regularly without the thought of buying anything. Mm-hmm. Go to look. Take your camera, take photos of the tags, and come back home and say, you know what, I think this one here will go really good here. You can hold up your phone and look at the site and say, I think this would really go good here because of the shape of it. That's the other thing you need to think of, is the shape of a plant. Is it going to be a weeper? Is it going to be upright? Is it going to be just a rounded shrub? You don't want to put the wrong shape in the spot that you have.
Right. This is a long-term investment, so it shouldn't be a one-hour decision in order to make that long-term, lifelong investment.
I think you're right there, too. Is like when you're buying a tree, it's the same thing. Right. If it's going to last 100 years, you want to make sure that it's like you buy your house. You're going to live in your house. You want to make sure that it's the right house for you and for your family.
And you don't plant it right up next to the window when it's supposed to get 25 feet wide.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And also, you can actually do harm to your home and your foundation if you plant things too close to the foundation. So it's important that you're really mindful of that as well.
So with that being said, maybe you have a shrub or a hedge that you do have to trim or prune for whatever reason. Maybe you bought the 50% off one or whatever. What is the biggest mistake when people trim their shrubs and hedges, and how can they prevent making those mistakes?
Well, the one thing is, take a look at the shape of the shrub. Just like people, we all have different shapes, and we have shapes because of our genetic heritage, and we need to really marvel at that. That's really amazing. You know, we're all human, so we don't all look alike. And it's the same thing with plants. When you look at a shrub and you say, oh, you're beautiful, but you're shorter. I think I'm going to put you along the walkway because you won't be growing over the walkway. You're going to stay contained in that spot. Or if you have a big area and you really want to have an area to be filled, go with a larger shrub. And if you're going to be pruning it, make sure you don't prune it into a meatball, because not all shrubs are created equal, just like people. We want to use their best attributes to make your landscape look the best possible way it can, and also to attract diversity of animals and birds and all different types of species, because the greater the diversity within your garden, the better it's going to be from an insect and disease circumstance. You don't want to have all of one thing either. You want to make sure that you have a diversity of shrubs as well. So if you're going to be pruning, say, a multi-stemmed shrub like a forsythia, you're going to take out the oldest canes right to the ground. And when you do that, these older stems are going to be much taller than the stems that are shorter. And you're going to pull those out, and you're going to see a smaller shrub within that larger shrub. And it'll have the same beautiful shape, but just smaller. So that's the way you should be pruning, not in meatball form.
Right. Well, Eva, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered us. How can our listeners find out more about you? How can they get that book?
They can go to evamonheim.com, and the book is right on the tab on the top. So they can go there, and they can have their choice of how they want to purchase it. There's a lot of different options, whether you purchase it through me or whether you purchase it through your favorite gardening store or bookstore. That's the best way to do it.
Well, Eva, we thank you for the knowledge you've allowed to have on this few minutes we've been given, not only for Holly and myself, but all of our listeners, and we thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much, and I wish you continued success on your show.
Well, we thank you very much for that.
For more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.